Hey there, are you a happiness seeker? Have you survived trauma and pain? And are you ready to heal and transform? Then stay tuned in. You are listening to the Open to Happiness podcast, and I am your host, Nicoleta. Today, I will be talking about mental health and happiness with Matt Hussey, journalist, therapist, and educator from London. Hello, Matt, and very welcome to our Open to Happiness podcast.
Thank you very much, Nicoleta. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure for me as well. Where shall we start, Matt? Can I ask you directly, what is happiness to you?
It's a great question. I think happiness to me is, I see it in a kind of different way. I think happiness is often described as a kind of opposition to sadness, right? That they are these polar opposite things that are a constant kind of conflict with each other. And I think for me, that is just the opposite is true, right? Happiness, I think, is the idea that out of sadness can come great joy and positivity, but also out of happiness can come great sadness and sorrow, right? It's, I think it's, for me, happiness is a an idea that we have got the things we wanted, or we have kept hold of the things that matter, but at the same time also accept that those things, by their very definition, are not permanent or eternal. So it's kind of a, I guess, an existential response to that question, I guess.
It's a beautiful one. I love the depth of it. I like to go to these depths. If I may ask, what was your relationship with happiness? Has happiness been on your path a lot naturally? Did you have to strive for it? Are you pursuing it, or you just allow life to unfold? If you want to share as much as you feel comfortable to share with us.
Sure. Yeah. So happiness for me, I think certainly for more than the first half of my life, was something that I didn't feel was possible or accessible, or something that I was entitled to, perhaps. The first half of my life, I'd say, was very much, felt very difficult. I definitely quite a sensitive child growing up, and I grew up in a family that there was a lot of kind of conflict, a lot of challenges, you know, mental health challenges that were perhaps not really spoken about, or maybe identified in the way they could have been. And so growing up, happiness was something, was a kind of Hollywood thing, right? It was something you watched other people have and do, as opposed to someone like me could access or reach. I think, you know, what changed that, you know, and the difference between then and now is, I think there's an assumption, or I think I had an assumption, that happiness is a thing that gets given to you. It's a kind of like, yeah, there's a kind of cosmic balance of things, and your term for happiness is, you know, given to you by this sort of thing, whatever you choose to believe. I think the shift for me has been around the idea that happiness is a pursuit in a lot of ways, but it's also perhaps deeper than that. It's in the recognition that we have agency and the ability to shape our lives in ways that can elicit and bring out moments of joy and happiness, but also at the same time, just as much as we have that capability to do that, we also have moments where the opposite is true, right? We may make decisions that lead to great sadness and loss and grief and all these kinds of things. And so, yeah, happiness for me has become something that, if I was to sum it up, I would say that I'm in a dialogue with, probably the best way of describing that.
Interesting. So you're quite philosophical as well. It's not just, you know, this psychological perspective that we tend to have as therapists on our human existence and the way we experience life, the way we engage with our emotionality. Very beautiful. So what happened from that moment when you were young? And like me, you've been through some childhood trauma. You mentioned conflict. You mentioned some mental health challenges. I had the same in my environment, in my family environment. I wonder, how was the journey from there to here, where you can reflect from a conceptual space to actually understand what this might mean? And how did you feel throughout this time, throughout this journey, arriving at this point in life?
Yeah, so for me, I touched upon it before. So my family, you know, I came from a very matriarchal family. My family were from working class, were from the north of England. They're from a very poor part of England. And my parents had children very, very young, and they had children not long after they knew each other, which was very normal for that time. But I think underlying that was some historical trauma from my mum and her family that then gets repeated and played out in our family. And for me, that kind of became very normal, that there was a kind of absence of, you know, love and affection and all these sorts of things. There was a kind of independence was always encouraged, and a kind of self-determining quality was always encouraged. And, you know, at the best of times, that was something that was really positive, right? It allowed me to sort of choose my own path in lots of ways. But then at its worst, it also meant that I never felt I was entitled or allowed to ask for things from people and for help and support. And so that kind of came to a head when I was in my 20s, and basically my parents had divorced and were going through a really messy divorce. They were fighting in the courts for years. And my kind of whole support network kind of collapsed around that. So I had ended a relationship at the time that was very significant. We lived together, we owned a property together. We also worked for the same company at the time. So I was as a journalist back then. And so I left that job. So kind of really quickly, me and my sense of family, a sense of home, a sense of connection, relationships, professional identity, all kind of collapsed very quickly, one after the other. So that was kind of like my kind of rock bottom. I was about sort of 27. And the journey from there to now has really been through my own kind of personal therapy journey, right? I Googled, you know, therapist local to me, as I think most people do these days, and found a woman who seemed very kind and seemed to be someone who I could work with. And after the second session, she asked me why I chose her. And I said, because, you know, when you look at therapists online, you have a long list of people's faces. And I said, your face seemed to speak to me, and I thought you had a nice face. And then she stopped the session straight away and didn't really give me much explanation as to what had happened. I felt very kind of rejected. She said, you should work with a man. And she recommended a colleague. And so I went and started working with him. And a lot of the kind of projections and anger I had towards my family, especially my father, kind of came out in the work. But for me, I had no real understanding of what was happening to me. I know that I would turn up, I would kind of feel like I'd sort of slip my stomach open and all my guts fall out. And then 50 minutes would go by and I had to kind of gather myself back up and go back out into the world. And I didn't really feel very kind of supported in the work. And so I did that for 6 weeks and left that, and he asked me to do an exit interview, and I said, you know, what this sense of experience feels like to me is I turn up here and, you know, we kind of open the keys to a door inside me, which is a door with a set of stairs that goes into a dark room. And what happens is I go down there alone, and then you stand at the top of the stairs and just wait for me to do stuff. I said, I felt totally alone. And he's like, yeah, but you're doing so well. You're projecting. You're bringing all this kind of anger into it. You're engaging with all the material. I was like, but when were you going to tell me that? Right. So ended that work, had some time off, and then tried again and found an Italian therapist who I continue to work with to this day. So that's 13 years now, and have gone on this very patient journey into knowing myself, knowing how I interpret what people see of me or what I think people expect of me, and learning to kind of make a kind of peace with all that. And so I think the sort of journey of happiness has really been a journey of, I guess, self-discovery in a way, learning to live in my own skin, learning to process experiences that I found very painful in a different way, and learning how to integrate everything that I've been through while at the same time not believing that that's all that I am and all that I can be. That's it.
Wow, it's a beautiful journey, Matt. Thank you so much for being open and actually sharing in an authentic way what it's been like for you. Because I see this as a journey of surviving and thriving through life, and the discovery that comes through this, which you'd kind of do mostly on your own. Of course, if you have the privilege of finding a therapist that is actually guiding you. And it's holding your hand, and it's there for you to contain you and help you when you're about to fall. That's amazing. It's so precious when you have that, which is not so easy. It's not that easy to achieve. We think it is, but it's not that easy.
Absolutely. Yeah. And just to speak to that, there were countless times where I was frustrated, annoyed, like I felt like, so my therapist would take every August off, like she'd all her clients should have a break from every year. And the first few times she did that, I felt very abandoned. And and the thing about, I think what I learned from that experience that I try to repeat with my own clients is, to your point around this idea of it can be difficult, I think it's supposed to be difficult, right? I think it's, what I wanted in the beginning wasn't really where I ended up or what I realized I needed, really. In the beginning, I came to therapy because I said, I feel numb. I've got all these things that I can see should be painful for me, but I don't feel anything. And I got these things that should seem positive to me, but I don't feel anything there, so fix me, right? That's kind of how I started my therapeutic journey. What I realized with this therapist, over a very long period of time, was that really what I was there for was I needed to have a reparative relationship with a maternal figure that allowed me to explore parts of myself that I felt I wasn't allowed to, that I felt I had to deal with on my own, to be able to be upset, to be able to be angry and frustrated in front of someone that, as you said, can contain that, but without me really understanding that's what I needed. And that's the kind of the mystery, I guess, of therapy, is this idea of what the client needs from you may not be known by the client.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's your skill and your art as a professional to allow for that to unfold. And it's not easy. I mean, I see it myself. I'm still learning, and I will be learning until the end of my life, really. Like every other human being, if they are open. The nature of this podcast, the opening to happiness, is not about, it's not just an invitation, really. You can make of the title whatever you want. It is an invitation for you to open to happiness, because if you're not open, the happiness could be just right here within you. You're not connected with it, so it's pointless. It doesn't exist. But it's a bit more than that. It's an invitation to actually be open to experience, be open within yourself. Not necessarily closed off to the world, be open to the world, be open to connect, and so on. And I think it takes a bit of time to find a good match in the therapy world, as I have experienced myself changing, switching from one therapist to the other, thinking, okay, I've taken this leg of the journey with this person. I don't feel like I can go any further. There was like a blockage, finding someone else and then feeling a bit guilty sometimes, thinking maybe it's my resistance. What am I doing here? I wasn't sure. But I've been with someone for a good number of years, just like you. And then I feel it's somehow a moment of readiness for you as a client in therapy to open up to a different kind of vulnerability within you in the presence of another. And it's also the readiness for the other person, the receiver, to be able to be there for you. And I think the first therapist that you had, obviously I wasn't there, I can't really comment on the person, but maybe it was a therapist that was a little bit mistaken around the erotic transference. She wasn't clear what was going on in there. Because we do choose people in our life based on the physiognomy. The physiognomy talks to us. It tells us many things that we can't even describe in words. The language is quite poor. And the second one, maybe he was frightened himself to go down the stairs. And because he hasn't been there himself, he couldn't have taken you. He couldn't have guided you somewhere where you were about to go as a client. Sometimes, you know, we meet clients that have had a little bit of a journey, which is quite unfamiliar to us. They've been somewhere where we've not been. And it can be scary and you feel a little bit incompetent or unskilled or unprepared. And it's fine to say it. You know, I didn't have this experience. You either allow me to go through it, to see if we can walk through this together, or maybe you can make a referral and so on. But I'm so happy that you found someone that is there for you and it's offered that reparation that you needed. Because I think I always say to my clients that sometimes come and say, I've never told this to anyone. I've never spoken to anyone. You know, I'm thinking, oh my God. So this is, it's like, it feels, oh, I'm privileged. Look, she's trusting me, but this is our delusion. It's our, you know, grandiosity that comes through, which is fake. It's false. Or, you know, how can this person feel so lonely and so hesitant? And, you know, especially in very close connections, to actually pay for a service, for a professional to be the listening ear that they need. And I always tell them that you only need one person in this life to be there for you, to accept you unconditionally. We go back to Carl Rogers, really, and the humanistic view, to accept you, to care about you, to not judge you, to just be there and welcome you and embrace you every week. No matter what, no matter happens, you know, and that, unfortunately, that person is sometimes, you know, a professional. So I'm so happy that you had this experience. You turned whatever happened, like hardship and adversity, into something beautiful in life. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's in you, it's in me, it's in us, it's part of us, but it's not alive right now. We can choose to, you know, give ourselves into a trigger if we have unresolved stuff. But we can also choose to be present, to be, you know, consciously aware in this very moment. So I'd love to know, what was the moment when you realized that this is your calling, that you need to train yourself, you need to become a therapist yourself? Because you want to heal, you have interest in healing, and obviously helping others, being of service.
Absolutely. And I think for me, it was after years of my own therapy where I kind of, when I feel completely different about my own life and my own story. And I thought to myself, everyone should experience this. I think this is great, right? This is a kind of really liberating thing. And so my journey into that world kind of was a kind of stop-start journey. I went and did my kind of foundation year in 2014. And you know, got exposed to some of the theories and the ideas. And what was brilliant about the course I was in, the center has actually closed just recently. It's the WPF, the Westminster Pastoral Foundation over in London Bridge. What was brilliant about the training they offered was, as part of the seminars and the theory and the you know, experiential work that you had to do, we had group therapy every week for 90 minutes. Which for me was the first real opportunity to really understand what therapy really is in a kind of very focused sense. It's a kind of therapy, you know, traditional one-on-one therapy is a kind of a controlled environment for a relationship to unfold in a kind of predictable and knowable way, I think. In group therapy, you're that's happening in the group, obviously with 10 people, with each other, with the facilitator, with themselves. And it was kind of like it was in real time. So obviously in one-to-one therapy, you get to reflect on past experiences. And obviously sometimes there's some things in the room to work on. Group therapy was just like, oh no, the people are firing live rounds at each other all the time and hurt by each other and being really, really damaged by each other. And I came out of that experience, I think everyone in that group did, really understanding something quite profound about how we get on as in relationships, how we kind of survive in relationships. And I still see those that group every 6 months. We still meet up, and our lives, we've all moved to different parts of the country and different lives, and but there's still this real connection that we experience together. And I think, but at the time when I finished that year, I was so overwhelmed by how insignificant and important the work was. I didn't feel ready for it. So I took a few years out, and then what brought me back to it was I used to have a very stressful job, and I'd have to kind of like just take these breaks where I'd go away. I have a partner, but I would go away alone because I just needed to be kind of alone. And I went up to Scotland, to the Isle of Skye, and just sort of experienced this sort of massiveness of that beautiful place and the mountains and all the wonderful things that were there. And I was listening to a lot of Esther Perel, as I think every therapist does these days, and just listening to that aliveness that I felt from the group work, where because she would see record clients live, and you could see the dynamics kind of playing out. And it was beautiful to watch, or listen to rather. And I kind of came back from 3 days trekking around kind of this island in Scotland, and go, that is the only thing I want to do. I want to be engaged in this thing that is so integral to our survival as a species, the relationship. And I want to be able to help people tolerate the messiness of it. This relationships aren't easy, and being with people isn't easy, and coming from a family is not easy. And I think I wanted to kind of help, kind of just sort of speak to that and go, like, no one said it was going to be easy, and therefore if we can accept that there is difficulty in our life, and that's kind of the price of admission for being a person, it allows other doors to open and other opportunities to kind of arise. So that's kind of where it all started for me. And then I went and did my training in London, and yeah, loved it. Found some parts of it frustrating and annoying, but I think that's just what's supposed to happen. And yeah, I have my private practice, and I teach at one of those places I did my placement. I teach new therapists about safeguarding and first sessions and things like that. And yeah, love it.
Ah, what an amazing journey, Matt. I'm so happy for you because you've discovered this because you felt attracted to it in a way. It was like a magnet. It was there on your path ready to happen. But you didn't rush. You took your time to get ready yourself for it. And I think when you talk about this journey and you talk about discovering these beautiful people that have researched for years and years what it means to be in a relational life, in a relational world, like Esther Perel that you mentioned, and her therapist, Terry Real, he's actually invested a lot of time in discussing about and exploring and researching men's mental health, which we're going to hopefully open up and talk about a little bit now. To see your perspective as a therapist and a man yourself on mental health and everything else. If you follow them, you realize that at the core of our life, it's our relational aspect, our social relational aspect. Yet, what brings us the most suffering in life is the relational world itself. Because any kind of trauma, I'm writing about this, I'm actually researching this myself for my own interest and benefit, and hopefully for the others as well. In my own healing journey now, I feel that any trauma has a relational component. It's not happening by itself. Even if you self-harm, it's still a harm, a trauma in the relationship with yourself, and so on. But it can be with the family, with the other people, with the entire world, structures and institutions and stuff. So at the same time, let's think about the paradox of this modern world. We all know how important it is that everything happens within a relationship, and yet we don't teach our children about our relational world. Everyone somehow starts life, and most of life until late, probably in life. Some of them never consider actually exploring themselves in their relationship with themselves, and then how do they relate with others? So this is a very interesting perspective, really, because from this angle, we can understand mental health. Because I think we get hurt in relationships and we heal in relationships. And the power of the group, the power of the community, I think it's, I didn't imagine that that would be something that I would consider. I've been through experiential groups like this, like therapy groups in trainings as well, and I found them very challenging. But this is, when I look back now, I'm thinking, this is us humans unleashed. Like, we are now showing exactly what's in us, who we are, our fears, our projections, whatever it is, you know, it's just there. So the power of the community, I think we do get hurt in relationships, but we still need to heal in relationships. So let's move it gently into the area of mental health. So as from a therapist on Adam, what are we doing with our mental health? With all of this relational trauma that starts from little things like family relationships and expands into global issues that we will have to face now, you know, with the inequality and prejudice and all of this imbalance that we find in the world. Why do we have this mental health? Has it always been there? I mean, the psychiatry is quite a young, you know, medical specialty. The anti-psychiatry movement has been there for 100 years, I think, if not more, maybe. What's going on? Why don't we really have this conversation? I'd like to hear your thoughts on mental health and why do we medicalize it and everything else.
Yeah, great question. It's a part of the work I spend a lot of time in. I think where I'd start is, it was something Melanie Klein said. She said, because obviously she spent lots of time working on with children and that formative relationship with mother and child. And she said, there's an assumption that we experience pure love, right? As a baby or as a toddler or as an adult. And she said, it's not true. We experience love through a lens that also has frustration, anger, disappointment, pain, and suffering. And so I think what she was speaking about there was this idea that to experience, as you've talked about, Nicoletta, this idea of the relationship means that we must let everything through that door, right? If we open the door to a relationship, we want joy and connection and intimacy and understanding. But to do that, we must also let in all the other stuff too, right? And I think that is something that I think a lot of society today really struggles with. And I think it struggles with the idea that, or wants to believe the idea that we can avoid suffering in life, that we have achieved some sort of profound understanding about what it means to be a person to such an extent as that we can protect someone from suffering. And I think that's what really the huge surge in psychiatry and medication and all that kind of what is really trying to address this notion that when you feel pain, we can alleviate it immediately. And I think the challenge we've fallen into with mental health is that we have created this adversarial relationship in ourselves between suffering and safety. And there is a great writer, a guy called James Davis, who wrote a beautiful book called The Importance of Suffering, and I recommend everybody read it. And he really talks about this idea of historically suffering was seen as just life, right? Life was suffering in a kind of existential sense. And he talks about a lot of artists and creative people whose suffering was an integral part of who they were, right? And I've got a big list of people I'm going to be writing about who, you know, Caravaggio to Marilyn Monroe to Richard Nixon to Winston Churchill to all these people had incredible suffering, internalized suffering in their lives. But because of the kind of cultural and sociological world they existed in, the expectation of what to do with it was different from what we feel now. That we obviously we had different language to describe sadness. We had melancholia was a very big thing. If you think about any kind of trauma, we had kind of hysteria, which was a largely gendered term that we'd only apply for women, and that didn't disappear till the 1960s. But there was before those that when we started to want to look for this language of mental health, there was just an assumption and expectation that life had sadness and suffering within it. And I think sadly, with the best of intentions, you know, with all the weight and power of science and research and the pharmaceutical industry to go, we want to help people never suffer. I think by accident, we have created a very different sort of suffering. We've created a very, it's a kind of numbed suffering. So it's kind of like I can take away the extreme pain that you may feel, the extreme suffering you may feel, but I don't resolve it. It sort of remains as a kind of residue within you. And I think that creates a really different experience for people. And if you look at since the 1950s, the increase in mental health disability payouts in the US, the UK, Australia, Canada, Sweden, Finland has climbed, right? The number of people seeking help for mental health has skyrocketed. At the same time, the number of people taking antipsychotic medication has also gone up. And so I think there's this thing that's going on, and you talked about the antipsychotic movement, and I think it's a part of this discussion around mental health is we so desperately want the idea of to alleviate suffering instantly and painlessly. But to believe that means that we overlook and ignore the importance of suffering. You know, in my own story, out of so much suffering came so much meaning and opportunity.
Exactly.
And I think that for me is the kind of we're in this sort of struggle between obviously suffering is not pleasant and it's horrible and the world is so full of it, right? But I think it's a delusion to think that we can create a society or a world that doesn't have it. Of course, we can create a fair society, a just society, a society that gives people opportunity. But inside all of that will remain suffering and inequality and injustice.
Yes.
And that's a really hard thing to accept, I think, for a lot of people that, we look at the world at the moment, there are terrible things happening. And we live in an age where we can experience that in real time through smartphones and the ability to send images and video across the world instantly. And I think our natural response is to either want to ignore it or push it away. But I think actually where I'm left with it is question go, actually, is there not something to be understood in all this, to be learned, to be built on, as opposed to pushed away? And that's my
Ah,
thing.
that's absolutely fantastic because you're right. We don't really focus on the basics of what it means to be a human being, what it means to be a relational being, but also what it means to be a self-reflective being. If you don't teach your children to be self-reflective and to have self-inquiries within, if you don't allow them to understand the spectrum of human emotions, and let them really sit with them, whatever they are. Just reassuring them that emotions are transient. They are just like the nature. They will not be there forever. And they are, like Buddha said, I mean, it's 2,500, 600 years ago, Buddha said it in one simple sentence, you know, there is suffering. This is the first truth. And we've forgotten with our modernizing and progress and new world, whatever we want you to do. The science has the new sciences, they have forgotten about the ancient, you know, wisdom that we all carry within us. That's why I think you're right. We're disturbing ourselves because we don't accept what is. We don't live in a sense of presence and embracing of
Oh.
what's happening, what's coming. We always seek something different, you know. We are into instant gratification and we want more. Extremely, I would say that because of how this new world is changing so fast, especially with the digitalization now, that allows you to see what's going on in the world. I think our desires are increasing. And we go back to Buddha, who said, obviously, at the core of your suffering, it's your own desire and your own expectations. So then, okay, we become a little bit harming in the relationship with ourselves. Maybe we have expectations around the world, people around us, partners, families, and so on. So our relational life is struggling because there's relational trauma, there's hurt, there's injury, there's wounds, there's issues. Again, we've never been taught how to deal with our struggles, with our conflicts. No one is an expert in this. We're learning on the go, I suppose. We need to learn through doing, to actually navigating them. And what do we do then? What do we do with our hurt? Because this, I think, because we're not really educated around our own mental well-being, what it means to be well. We are not in agreement what it means to be well, really, from a culture to another, from an age group to another. There's something else. It must, I don't know, be well-being and mental health and fitness. So it's very interesting that in a way the society is forming us, is programming us. But then it's the society that has to help us somehow, because we wait for the help. We look for the help outside. We want the government, we want the healthcare system to be there for us and help us with our mental health. But sometimes we fail to realize that we have the resources we need. We can go inside and start doing something ourselves. We may need some specialized support, of course, but in waiting for that, there is still something we can do. We can be, we can feel empowered by everything that we have, the tools that we have. With the charity that I run, the Significant You, we're trying to actually create, you know, mental health campaigns to help people realize that the first person that can help you is yourself. That's the first, you know, the first area of support. Then it's your community, your tribe. And then it's the global world, the government, you know. Try here first, try with yourself. So what is it that we do with this relational trauma that is affecting our mental health? All these problems, all these struggles, you know, from a little argument between a couple to some global issues that we see in the Middle East or in Ukraine with Russia and so on. How can we heal? Or maybe let's start with the impact. What is the impact of the relational trauma? And how can we heal from this? Can we really heal?
Great, yeah, great question. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think for me, what I see happening, and I love that you've introduced trauma on small micro scales and also big macro global scales. And I think that's kind of the unique challenge of our age, right, is for the first time in history, we can be exposed to pretty much everything, right? All at once. We can be exposed to the exquisite suffering happening in the Middle East, to the terrifying horrors of what's happening to the Ukraine, to the cost of living crisis on our doorstep, to the family strife because it's Christmas, to the interpersonal difficulties with our partners and colleagues, and all the way down to the kind of almost the atomic level of ourselves. And I think what's the challenge of all this is it can often feel like it has complete access to us all the time. So I recently wrote a newsletter around asking, are we in a new age of anxiety? And the age of anxiety was a term written by W.H. Auden in the 1940s. You know, it was after the Second World War. You know, it was symbolizing all this huge change. And I think what I found really useful is Jacques Lacan's definition of anxiety, right? And I've never heard this before, but I think it's really useful. He described anxiety as the expectant dread of another. And he kind of gives a kind of weird description of what this is. So he said, the praying mantis, you know, the insect, the female praying mantis has a tendency to rip the head off the male mantis after they've made love, right? He said, anxiety is you are sitting in front of a female praying mantis and you're wearing a mask of another mantis, but you don't know whether it's a male or female mask is what you're wearing. So therefore, you have no idea if that mantis in front of you is going to rip your head off or leave you alone. And I think this is such a lovely way of looking at it, because I think the challenge of relational trauma and our ability to experience it both globally and very, very personally is that they can often feel like that world comes at us without permission, right? It knocks on the door of us and goes, I'm here now, you must deal with me. I think a useful example is it's late at night and you're at home and someone knocks on the door, right? That's anxiety, because there's suddenly the want of another is made apparent to you. And I think with the age that we live in, where information kind of comes at us through our phones are talking to us all the time, is they could feel like there's a lack of permission with what we choose to experience and engage with, and engage with the anxiety of other people and the relationships that we have. And I think the way to deal with this kind of the trauma that kind of comes through all this is to really kind of go, okay, I need to be able to feel like I can control this. I need to be able to sort of like have a kind of traffic manager who can go, right, wait there, I'm dealing with this first, right? And to give us a sense of agency in our own lives to go, okay, so what is the most pressing sense of dread that I feel right now? What is the thing that's causing me the most thing? And for some people, it may be global and existential. And for some people, it may be tiny and local. And I think the ability to engage fully with that thing, to your point before, Nicoletta, about I can do something about it, and therefore I can alleviate that sense of anxiety, and I can also manage how often it comes and knocks on my door late at night, I think is the kind of challenge that sits ahead of all of us. It's kind of like we have been given all the world's information to us at once and make it accessible all the time, which is an incredible gift in some ways, but also an incredible curse. Because we can know everything all the time. And I don't think we're necessarily equipped for that. So I think it's about how helping people feel like, you know, my partner, she uses social media. I don't use it so much. And she says, you know, she'll be scrolling through her feed and there'll be suddenly a video or picture that's really disturbing. And she's like, I didn't ask for that. And so it's kind of like they can feel like that kind of like porous. The world just seems to happen to me all the time. And so her response has been, I'm using it less because I need to be able to feel I can exhibit some control over what comes into my head, what comes into my thoughts. And I think that's really the first place we can really start, is to help people feel like there is a lot to worry about and to be fearful of. And there's a lot of trauma in us and other people and around the world. But we have to feel like we can address that in at our own pace and in our own way, because otherwise I think what happens is the response is this kind of collapse where we kind of go, can't help anything, can't help anyone, and we kind of become more isolated in our ability to believe that change is possible. So therefore it seems less likely that we can change things, and therefore it kind of creates this perpetual dread, I think, that we feel incapable of being able to manage.
Wow, beautiful exploration. So what do we do now? Because it's a fact, relational trauma is here. And as much as we try to heal a little bit from what happened yesterday, today a new day emerges and new challenges arise again. So it feels like it's a constant, struggle really for us to learn to self-regulate, to learn to live in mutually satisfying relationships, positive relationships, to learn to maybe create a relational life around us that is suitable to us and pleasing and comfortable.
Right.
How do we help people in from our seats? And maybe later on we talk about how can they help themselves.
Yeah, great question. And I think you touched upon it earlier, Nicolessa, when you said that, you know, that it's nice to see a kind of my kind of philosophical side, you know, merging with my sort of therapeutic side. And I think that's really the way forward here is, I think the therapeutic work that we do, so often it gets seen and treated in isolation, right? We work with individual clients mostly, and we work with local ideas of the self and all that kind of stuff. But I think actually the kind of gift of this work, of the understanding that we get, is that it means that we should be the opposite of isolated. We should be integrated. You know, I read a great piece on the internet yesterday saying that psychiatry won't save society, people will, right? It's the idea that we need to stop seeing ourselves as this little corner where we're just helping people deal with distress and start seeing it as a bigger job and a bigger role of kind of going, actually, no, this is a societal challenge. Because I think too often as therapists, because we see the individual, we work with the individual's challenges. But I think when you take a step back, what you see is actually a lot of the clients I work with are affected by very large things: cost of living prices, policy, politics, you know, the decisions that we have no control over or no feeling of control over, that cause huge distress. And I think for us as therapists, we need to exert a bit more kind of confidence that what we've understood about suffering, about relationships, about how the interpersonal is really the thing that determines whether we have a good life or a terrible life, needs to take more of a role in a society where leaders of communities and leaders of societies are given the kind of tools to go, actually, like, to look after people doesn't take very much, right? There's a kind of, use called Maslow's very simplified version of needs, right? We need food and shelter at the base level. We need a sense of security and the ability to maintain relationships. And we need to be able to self-determine and self-actualize in a positive way. And for most people, if you give them a chance to do that, they will do that. Right? And I think this is too often as therapists, we see our role as too separate from how society works. And I think that needs to change. I think we need to be a bit more forthcoming, because we're the ones that are having to kind of put people back together again, or help people put themselves back together again. And I think actually, you know, prevention is better than protection, right? If you can help society not be so callous and careless, people won't fall into crisis as often. People won't reach the absolute depths of despair of themselves, because there will be safety nets all the way through society, rather than a kind of, like, you know, and this is a sort of a slightly aside subject. I work in a private practice, but I have people come to me all the time saying, you know, I would really love to have therapy, but I can't afford it, right? Therapy is a luxury for the vast majority of people.
Indeed.
And I think that's a tragedy. And because I think the people that need it the most are often the people at the bottom of society, the people that have suffered the most, but yet have little access to it. And I know there's lots of charities that do fantastic work, but it's not enough. And I think that that's indicative of, if we're at the bottom trying to catch all these people, it's not to look at, like, how do we catch people better at the bottom? It's about how do we change what happens at the top, so that there's less people falling through these cracks of society. They're not held by the communities and not held by the safety nets that at different times in history we have provided. And so I think therapy and therapists need to take on a more active role in community work.
So interesting that you see it from your own personal perspective and professional perspective as a practitioner yourself, but you also think of the community and our role, the role that we all play individually and then obviously as a group, as a profession, a very important profession in the society or the global level. Oh, that, but there's so much disparity, honestly, when
Of
I think
course.
about it, between countries, between places in within the same country. If you look at London, if you just take London, between different boroughs. We in the same borough, I worked a lot in in Southwark in the past, and obviously we had some really nice residential places, but then we had the council estates at Elephant and Castle before they started to demolish, but there's still loads, a lot of disadvantaged populations there. So if you think about it, it's quite hard. I don't know who's gonna really create a policy around this that would be not just looking at the equality, but also the equity, give everyone what they need, make it equitable. It would be different, difficult. But I think you're right. We should all maybe reflect a bit more around the role that we have and do our best with the resources that we have, because eventually it all goes down to resources like time, energy, mental space, money, and so on. Beautiful. So now I would love to talk more with you. Maybe we can do it again. Towards the end of this episode, Matt, if you can maybe reflect a little bit on your three best teachings for all of those people that are listening and watching, how can they live a healthy, balanced, and fulfilling life?
Yeah, lovely, lovely question to end on. I think that the first thing is that is to accept and understand that happiness can is elusive by its very nature, right? It comes and goes. It's a kind of, I read somewhere that someone described it as a comet, circling in the galaxy. Because when it comes, it's great and it's there and it lights up the sky at nice and it makes things seem wonderful, and then it goes. And I think there's a lovely way of thinking about it that, that if we can find acceptance in that, that happiness is a kind of a visitor, not a resident, I think is a route to sort of a version of happiness. I think another thing is also that sadness, suffering, heartache, all these things, all these really hard things are the key to a lot of happiness. If I reflect on my own experience, the relationship I'm in now is a very happy and fulfilling one that gives me an incredible amount of meaning and purpose and intimacy and closeness. But I've only been able to achieve that by having lots of relationships that went wrong and lots of relationships that failed and lots of moments where I have to deconstruct a life with somebody else because it's ended. And I've had to learn really, really painful lessons around who I was in relationships and the role that I played in whether a relationship worked or not. I had to kind of stare at the parts of me that I didn't like looking at. And I think that's the sort of the second thing is it's we must be prepared to look at the worst of us in order to find the best of us. I think too often a lot of the kind of narrative around things like wellness and well-being is an over-focus on the positive. I think actually the opposite is true. If we learn to look at the darkness in us, we'll find incredible things and to see them as meaningful and useful rather than as nasty and horrible. And I think the last thing I'd say is it's kind of borrow from I don't know whether you're familiar with this, Nicoletta. It's the Harvard Grant study. It's the longest study of human behavior that's ever been undertaken. The guy who was oversaw the study for the longest, I think it's called Professor Valance, I think he's called. He wrote a book called Triumphs of Experience about what he had learned from 40 years of study. And they were all scientists and they used data and they collected everything and they measured everything and They were trying to answer this question, if you're not familiar with the study, of what was the biggest contributor to a good life? What made people live longer, feel more content, feel happy? And they followed, hundreds of people, and the study's gone on, and they now follow their children and their grandchildren. And they asked them all sorts of questions. And the single thing that was the biggest determinant of a happy and fulfilling life was the quality of the person's relationships. And I think that's the third thing. I think it's two, we are not islands. We're not these atomized things that exist in these little micro things of ourselves. We are a deeply connected, interconnected species that needs each other. It's far more than I think we realize. And I think if we want to have better lives, better communities, we really have to accept that the route to a better world is through each other, not just on our own. Like we, as we touched upon in this talk, we can't do a lot alone, but we can do a lot together. And I think that's, for me, probably the most important thing, and probably the thing that comes up in therapy the most. It's like the therapeutic work, I think, is the healing part is the relationship. Is this the thing that we can hold together and co-create between us and the client? And I think that applies to everything that I've done, the best experiences of my life have been with other people. So I think that'd be my third.
Absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much for this. So your teachings, in my understanding, first of all, of this would be that you must accept that happiness is transient. It comes and goes, and that's the nature of life. The second one, embrace your darkness, embrace the suffering. It can be a great teacher. And the third one, watch the quality of your relationships, because this is where the source of your happiness, or some happiness and safety and joy in life could be. Thank you so much, Matt. It's been a
You're
wonderful,
very welcome.
wonderful conversation.
It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you, Nicholas. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Where can people find out a bit more about you?
Yeah, so I have a newsletter that's kind of a website that's sort of becoming video and content. It's called The Brink, so Brink. If you Google it, you'll find it, and it's where I write a lot about this stuff. I'd like to kind of dig into this kind of stuff more because I think too often writing around mental health focuses on this too narrow an idea. And I think so you can find me there. Thebrink.me is the website. So, email me. I respond to everybody. I love talking to people. I just chat to people who follow me all the time just about their experiences. So please reach out.
Thank you so much. Thank you for everything, for being here, for spending time with us, for sharing your wisdom and your knowledge and everything you captured throughout all of these years in your personal journey, in your education, in your practice. Thank you so much. You have listened to the Open to Happiness podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, show us your love, share, subscribe, or give us a review. Thank you.